This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, it's your home for XL editions of Rewind to Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown as we go live for our patrons on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with XL editions containing the news of the day, questions, and feedback. And throughout the month of January, you get a free month when you sign up for a full year. PostWrestlingCafe.com.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is Pollock and Thurston for Wednesday, January the 29th. And we are joined by Brandon Thurston as the city is in a state of mourning. I feel that we should all put our heads down and pour one back for the great Buffalo Bills and their 2024-25 run that came to an end this past Sunday against the Kansas City Chiefs. Brandon, we are also sorry.
Have you seen this press conference with Josh Allen?
No.
He is distraught.
Oh. Is this I guess this is an emotion shared by many in Buffalo. Is there like an overall just begrudging sense of dread that comes the later you go into the playoffs that, you know what, is this too good to be true? Probably.
Yeah, I thought there was a chance, but I understand that the Chiefs, not only do they have the referees on their side, but they are favored.
This was a competitive game. I mean, would you rather have been the Bills or the Washington Commanders on Sunday? I mean, the Commanders were just blown out.
They were destroyed by the Eagles. I was shouting things at the TV throughout the game. The game concluded with me taking my Bills hat and throwing it across the room. Apparently I was slapping my leg a lot because my leg was real sore the next day.
Oh, were you super kicking your TV?
Maybe I should have.
Did you see the viewership for this game?
57 million viewers.
That's incredible.
The biggest AFC championship TV rating on record.
Well, you have that consolation prize. So we are once again going to get the Eagles and the Chiefs on Super Bowl.
Which
Super
is what
Bowl
everyone
Sunday.
Needed.
Yes. Yes. With Tom Brady's first Super Bowl in the booth.
Yep. Brady's in the Super Bowl again, I guess.
Yeah. I find that like I'm an observer of what goes on.
Did you
NFL.
Watch the game?
No, I didn't watch
it. You said you were a big Bills fan.
I'm updating the scores. Like on Sunday, I was like refreshing. I kept the scores. I have no desire to like sit down and watch a game. But regardless, I was rooting for your Buffalo Bills. Okay, I wanted to see them make it. I thought it'd be a way more compelling story. But instead, we get the Chiefs going for like their 80th Super Bowl this decade.
Yeah,
exciting stuff. Well, there you have it, everyone. That is your Super Bowl preview. $8 million, 30-second ads, apparently, for some outlets. Great if you can afford it.
I'm old enough to remember when they were just $1 million ads.
Back in my day. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know if TKO or WWE will invest in one this particular cycle.
But now we move on to politics. The RFK Jr. hearing is happening now. You go to our correspondent.
Yeah, do you think that we should be bridging into politics? Because
I'm ready to do post-politics. I told you last week off air.
I think that you might have a decent shot of now getting to become a credentialed media in the White House press briefing room.
Yes, what's her name? The new press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, is offering all of us the opportunity to apply for credentials with the White House.
Bloggers, podcasters, and social media influencers. We're just opening this up. Listen, this is going to be a gong show. I don't inherently hate this concept.
Yeah. The first thing I thought of is, man, maybe they're studying the wrestling business. Everyone loves to draw analogies between politics and pro wrestling these days, and Trump was at WrestleMania and blah, blah, blah. And this really jumps out to me as, oh, you know, I don't necessarily think that Donald Trump is sitting back on a Saturday night and watching a WWE press conference.
I think he might be. I think he has an opinion on was the Attitude Era better than this current era, and thought, you know what, that's what we need more of.
But gee whiz, if you ever wanted to make, you know, you could make, you know, the quote unquote legitimate media, if you ever just wanted to make them look like assholes, put a bunch of sycophantic media in there, and that really draws the distinction. And you could have, I mean, if I was totally self-interested and I wanted to create this environment where there was more of a positive reception to my administration's actions, I would absolutely want to get to basically remove the standards and get as many people in there who look at me favorably and who are willing to, you know, first of all, say congratulations before they ask their question, applaud when I'm about to speak, and just make everybody who asks a question that gets towards accountability and transparency, make those people feel like assholes, and make, you know, make all of the other media look like, you know, they're really in support of what you're doing.
I think this will be quite the political social experiment that we see. And if that is the case, I don't know what this necessarily says, but of all the moves that are going on.
For those people who do ask real questions, they're going to have an army of online fans attacking them and harassing them immediately after in real time if they're not already.
A fascinating podcast to listen to is one of the episodes of The Daily this week that covers the whole Blake Lively, Justin Baldoni situation and what happened on the set of their movie together and the background PR battle that has gone on. It's enlightening to any industry, pro wrestling, sports, politics, and especially Hollywood. Everyone should listen to this. I think it's a fascinating listen that you can take something away from this of it's not just about getting your story out. It's also discrediting the opposite side, and that in the event of so much confusion, that's a win. That there's it's so complicated that you can't take anything from this. And there's a whole, like, the flood the zone concept, and it's a really interesting lesson. So that's my my podcast recommendation of the week.
I don't know how you have time to listen to all the podcasts that it seems like you listen to. You're always like sending me a link of something. I'm like, how did you have time to get to that?
2x the speed, bro. That's how you go about it. I can't work and listen to something at the same time.
Yeah,
so usually
no,
if I'm on a walk or something, that's my listening time. But yeah, I've kind of overdosed on a political podcast at this point. My conclusion is the world's ending within a year. So that's the conclusion. So the countdown is on.
Okay.
But also the countdown is on until the Royal Rumble this coming Saturday night, as WWE and the Indiana Sports Corp have come together for this gigantic undertaking at Lucas Oil Stadium. And all signs point to this will be the most successful Royal Rumble in history and could be the most successful non-Saudi event in company history. Last numbers from WrestleTix, 62,636 tickets distributed. This gate, what would you assume, Brandon? Like, we're going to be hitting the eight figures potentially for
I saw
show?
You found that the minimum price is $200.
Yes, that's and the get-in price at the moment is just over $200.
Is that the secondary market or was that the first market?
This is the secondary market.
So I don't know, though, $200 is probably not an unreasonable assumption to make about the average ticket price. And I would think, let's say they're going to do, I don't know, 62,000. Let's say they're going to do, I don't know, 64,000 distributed. But let's assume that like 90% of that's actually going to be paid times, say, $200 average ticket price. We've got an $11.5 million gate, something in that range. We don't know what the gates were for last year's WrestleMania or for last year's Royal Rumble, which was in, I was there, which was in St. Petersburg.
That's right. Yeah. Alamo Dome was 2 years ago.
Correct. And we do know what the gate was for that, but I don't have it. I think it was well over 7 million, something like that. I'd have to look. If they did 10, I think that would be the biggest non-WrestleMania WWE event that they've gotten a gate for.
Looking up here, the Royal Rumble did a $7.3 million gate for the 2023 Rumble, which was $44,569 paid.
Yes. Or 7.7 including.
Yeah, if fees. You include the fees and such, WWE gate figure. So I think they're going to shatter that number. And whatever the number was last year, I think you could reasonably expect that this will be the record for a Royal Rumble event.
And I think we do know that the Detroit SummerSlam 2023 was over 8 million.
These are incredible numbers. Yes. We were at that Detroit show, as I recall.
Yes.
So this is the last year for now that the Rumble will be taking place in North America, because next year they are off to Saudi Arabia, and God knows what the amount is in revenue that they will be taking in for that show. I don't think it's going to beat the gate figures, but the overall fee you would think is, in addition to what a typical PLE is that they have taken over to Saudi Arabia. So it is a pretty big undertaking here for the Royal Rumble this coming weekend. And all signs point to a very, very big show. And also, this will be the first premium live event on Netflix for the international markets are getting it, such as us here in Canada.
Yes. The attendance, by the way, I saw this. This was a trending on their business partner X on the platform a few days ago when I think WrestleTix updated this, at least in the Taylor trends for me, that this was going to break. This has broken. I mean, according to the WrestleTix numbers, the attendance, just the number of attendees, depending on how you measure attendance. And the record is going back to the Shawn Michaels San Antonio 1997 Rumble, where the numbers that you can find out there for that that Royal Rumble are over 60,000, 60,500, something in that range. Now, I think the reports at the time were that there was a lot of free tickets involved in that.
Yeah, the gate for the show was about $480,000, to put it in comparison. So there were a lot of very inexpensive tickets to get that number up so high in 1997 during a pretty down period in company history. But I thought we could talk a little bit just about the Rumble itself, and I did just put out a piece on the Post Wrestling Cafe, looking at the history of the Royal Rumble, and Brandon has put together the history of pay-per-view buys for the Rumble, and you can see here that the first iterations of the Rumble, they kind of tested it out in 1987, where it was just a live event, and then the 1988 show was a free special on the USA Network, where, wouldn't you know it, the only date available, Brandon, was head-to-head with a Jim Crockett Promotions pay-per-view.
It's just that was just a coincidence.
It's just the way the schedule worked out.
I also learned that, you know who invented the Royal Rumble? Dick Ebersol.
Dick Ebersol, the person that certainly got it through after Vince McMahon thought this was a horrible idea. And Pat Patterson continued to push through, and Dick Ebersol said, "God damn, what are you thinking, Vince? This is great." So 1989, it goes on to pay-per-view. And as you can see here, like, certainly the Rumble, I think many people are very nostalgic for these 90s editions of the Rumble. The concept is very fun. But in terms of, like, this Rumble becoming, like, a real big entity, it's very much an Attitude Era escalation that you see here off the back of Steve Austin, Vince McMahon, where you see that jump from 98 to 99. And that's when this really does become just this, like, if there's one or two shows a year that you're stopping in to check up on, the Rumble is one of those shows. And you can just see, like, once it makes that big jump, kind of stays consistent. There's some dips along the way, but it's a pay-per-view animal until the network launches in 2014.
Yeah, do we know why this 1991 is such an anomaly at 440,000 buys compared to the 260 on either side of it in 90 and 92? Is it just the universe expanding at that time and enough momentum from the Hulkamania era?
This is in the midst of the Gulf War, and I imagine that, you know, that was how you showed you displayed your patriotism is by plopping down $30 to support Hulk Hogan in his bid to secure the country to safety. And
this is where Sergeant Slaughter wins the title from.
This is where Slaughter wins the title and sets up WrestleMania, which was, this was this is where ultimately like NBC like kicks the tires on Saturday night's main event and says goodbye to WWE after that long relationship. But yeah, the 1991 show, I mean, that's the number that we have. It is certainly an anomaly that stands out because that show, it's like, it's really the Rumble itself and Warrior Slaughter. Those are your big hooks for that particular show. And then, yeah, the much vaunted 1992 show, like right back to normal levels, which is probably the most well-remembered Rumble with Ric Flair and Bobby Heenan's commentary.
You know, it's interesting here. So it's to look at the Attitude Era and post by numbers for Royal Rumble. And it's pretty stable despite, clearly WWE being less popular as those years go on. It's, it brings to mind the point that people often raise about AEW, that their TV ratings have declined, their attendances have declined, where their pay-per-views hold up pretty well. I would suggest that's because the pay-per-view is the hardcore fan product. And it does hold up pretty well despite, going into the mid 2000s, certainly WWE is not nearly as popular as it was from 99 to 2001, but it's getting pretty close to those numbers in terms of buys for this event.
Yeah, I mean, it's one where, whatever kind of lull the company would go into in the 2000s, like this was always a very protected brand that the importance level was there. And this became a show that, like, even when we're looking at like lower ends, like 500,000 buys, I don't care what era you're in. That's an achievement right there that they're still maintaining throughout this. And of course, their high watermark there is the 2002 show that was all built around Triple H, and that's exceeding, that's post Attitude Era boom. By that point, it's kind of the last vestige of it. And we would see like just a consistent show that would continue on until, arguably reaching many more eyeballs by the time the network just became much more accessible and then moving to Peacock. And perhaps next year's Royal Rumble in Saudi Arabia could be the last Royal Rumble on Peacock.
It could be. Yes, very well could be.
As we will get the jump ball for WWE's streaming rights. And
as far as like figuring out how much money they're going to get from Saudi Arabia for the Royal Rumble next year, it might stick out in the live event segment, assuming they don't change their reporting method. But they do break out WWE's own live event revenue, and that's where they're reporting the Saudi Arabia money, which is different from their prior reporting method where they jammed it into media other. But anyway, it might stand out. So we might get some idea of how much they get. Certainly it'll be at least 50 million, you would think, and maybe a lot more than that.
Yeah, I mean, it will be noteworthy if they have the Royal Rumble plus the two usual Saudi Arabia shows next year, or if it's sort of like this is considered one of the two events, but there's some upgrade in terms of the fee attached to this. But 2027 will be the year that might be interesting if they toy with this idea of like two nights of Royal Rumble, which could be the next iteration of this event. We know we're getting at least one night for next year as well. But
it also is coming up in 2027. It's the end of the 10-year deal with Saudi Arabia, and we'll see if they renew that or come up with a new deal. Maybe make every PLE in Riyadh and Jeddah alternating.
NXT Jeddah could very well be in the near future. It's quite possible.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chalk Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chop-tees.com/post-wrestling.
Let's talk a little bit about let's go to Saturday night's main event, as WWE was back on NBC this past weekend for the second version of the show in the new era, and they ended up doing 1,494,000 viewers and a 0.33 in the 18 to 49 demographic. No Peacock viewership making its way into the public
sphere. There were no Peacock viewership tweets about how many unique accounts were watching it for at least a minute or two?
No, none at all. So
Peacock, sure? Have you checked Jimmy Trina's Twitter feed, though?
I have not, to be honest, but you can keep you can keep track of various accounts out there if any numbers drop attached to this. But
it was 700,000, I believe, last time, right?
700,000 was the number thrown out for the December show. So this time around, they were only down 6% from the December show, but we also saw a big drop in 18 to 49. That said, I thought like the viewership overall held up a lot more than I thought it was going to be. This felt like a much more not anywhere near the promotional muscle as the first show had. But what were they going up against this past Saturday, Brandon?
They were going up against the Lakers and the Warriors, as well as some college basketball that led on cable. But the first Saturday's main event was going against an NFL game. Is that right? So I would say that this competition was less tough, but it was also less hyped because it was the second one and not the first one. No Hulk Hogan there to draw people out to see if he was going to get booed or something like that. But we did have Jesse Ventura out there, and I don't believe we got a report on whether or not he did, in fact, hand out union cards on this night in San Antonio. But I would say it held up fairly well. On the whole, I think it's arguable that these numbers are a little bit disappointing based on what you might have hoped for. These are not this is kind of in the range of what SmackDown is doing, or maybe a little bit less, right?
I mean, for Friday night show, if we are comparing them, I mean, they're nearly identical when it comes to viewership. And in the case of 18 to 49, I mean, SmackDown was well ahead of Saturday night's main event.
Yes. And so, despite, remember the reach platforms here are meaningful. NBC is a lot stronger than USA Network is in terms of the number of homes it's in terms of its marketing power as well.
Yes. So, that was our second show. The third one, so we had Peacock release and unrelease the follow-up dates. If we are to be led to believe what Peacock had put out, the next one would be May 24th, which is Memorial Day weekend. And then the next one after that, July the 12th, which is the same night as the AEW show at Globe Life Field in Texas. So we will see if we get a head-to-head collision coming up. And speaking of collision, what was the outcome Saturday night going up against Saturday night's main event? Well, Collision, the homecoming edition of Collision, doing 250,000 viewers, down 27% this week, and a 0.07 in the demo, which would be their lowest in their normal time slot on Saturday since the last Saturday night's main event. So to no surprise, getting affected by airing against the WWE event, as well as the programming, the sports programming that Brandon just mentioned as well. So,
although we don't know the max number.
Don't know the max number either. I mean, man, they are keeping these this data very close to the vest, are they not?
Yes. Yes. I would think it's not that impressive if it's not worth sharing.
Well, those are our numbers for Saturday. And just quickly looking at Friday. So we are now several weeks into the expanded format of SmackDown. So we're getting a sense of what the patterns are for these 3 hours of SmackDown. This past Friday show doing 1,455,000 viewers, 0.44 in the demo. So this is their second highest that they've done since expanding to 3 hours, which, I mean, we have four shows to compare it to at this point. But Brandon, you have put together a wonderful graph. What has the expansion to 3 hours shown us about the audience interest in an extra 60 minutes of SmackDown on Friday nights?
Well, the third hour is the least watched, and it was from the first three-hour edition of SmackDown. And it has, you know, the attrition rate has gotten a little bit stronger, at least through three episodes. I believe I will have the fourth episode quarter hours later today, but It's getting a little, you know, people are sticking around less. And as you would expect, the 18 to 49, the younger viewers are harder to hang on to. And that's just usually the case for viewers across the board.
Did you expect this to be something that would be established this quickly, that this third hour is, or was this something that you thought would maybe take a bit more time before they would be able to see like this level of decrease in the third hour?
I mean, I think it's pretty well expected. We've got Raw having a 13-year history of the third hour being less of a priority, the stigma around the third hour being, you know, making the show too long and nobody wants to stick around from 10 to 11. I think this is not surprising.
I guess one difference, too, to point out is that when Raw did move to 3 hours, it was expanding on the front end from 8 till 9, whereas SmackDown, it's the back end that they are extending this show by. So you do kind of have an audience that the pattern already was 8 till 10, and as opposed to tuning in an hour early, you're being asked to stay an hour later. And I will just say that after being one of the few that has watched all of these 3 hour SmackDowns, I don't know how appealing this third hour has been. By the end of hour one, I'm looking down at my watch, Brandon.
Yes. Well, you're not the only one, apparently.
Yes. All right. Some other notes coming up from WWE today. They have confirmed their return to Paris for 2 nights at La Défense Arena. I'm probably butchering that, but it's a pretty big arena setting that they will hold Clash in Paris, August 31st, followed by Raw the next day, which for these international shows, you're going to be getting them live on Netflix. So the arena that they're running, it holds 40,000 for concerts, 32,000 for rugby. And, you know, they're breaking records everywhere, Brandon. But one record we don't talk about enough was brought up by Paul Levesque in this press release. Backlash France in Lyon last year broke arena records and decibel levels, demonstrating just how loud and passionate our WWE fans in France can be.
What is the decibel level number that is now the record? I want to know so I can put it in my spreadsheet.
Okay, that's going to be the next key performance indicator that we are going by for these shows is decibel levels.
Can we get an average decibel level, minute by minute average? What are we talking about here? Are we talking about just the peak? I think we're talking about the peak here.
You know, of all wrestling media out there, I've only seen one that has tried to fact check WWE on their decibel levels.
That's right.
I saw in person.
That's right.
Monitoring the decibel levels at Money in the Bank last year. But will Clash in Paris set a new decibel level record? Tune in on August 31st as they will no doubt have an incredible setting for the show. The France shows have been very, very well received, both in wrestling and MMA, where even Bellator has done exceptionally well when they have gone to Paris. So that was announced earlier today. Mm-hmm. WWE is returning to A&E for a 3 hour block beginning on February 16th. I mean, talk about flooding the zone. I mean, all we're talking about is more. They will have legends and future greats airing from 8 till 9:30. This is all February 16th, followed by a new edition of WWE Rivals hosted by comedian Gabriel Iglesias, and then WWE's Greatest Moments hosted by Michael Cole. So if you just want to make 3 hour WWE nights a part of your every evening routine, add Sundays to the list. It's a perfect palate cleanser from SmackDown, leads you right into Raw to NXT the next night. I mean, they're just taking over every night of the week.
Yes. Did you mention the LFG series?
Yes, that will be on. It's a 90-minute show to start things off where, look at this. Apparently, we're relaunching The Sopranos with The Undertaker, Booker T, Mickey James, and Bully Ray, who are in desperately need of some lighting here. These are our cloaked coaches that will be. Look at Bully Ray. I mean, yeah. Is he not looking for the future greats? Undertaker probably going to do a tutorial about carrying weapons into the locker room. And yeah, I'm sure we're going to get some wonderful television out of this this new series. But essentially, it is a reboot of Tough Enough, but done in a more modern setting. And yes.
Yeah,
this is all for an NXT contract that they are battling for.
Okay, you know this A&E deal that they've done for a few years now. I'm surprised that they continue to find some content to do because they've done sort of all the biography series, which is an intuitive, you know, content concept that you would do these biography series, which is already for the wrestling fans something that they've seen plenty of. But and then they had sort of the shoulder programming that comes on after it. But that they still find ideas to come up with to fill these blocks with is impressive.
So that is coming up on February the 16th. Let's talk a little bit about a story that you reported on in the award-winning WrestleNomics report, and that is regarding AEW pay-per-views and a potential additional outlet where you can purchase AEW
yes.
pay-per-views.
Let's not get confused here. All right, I don't want to get yelled at. That
make it very clear.
This is not like Peacock WWE. This is not part of your monthly subscription. It's just another avenue to pay whatever the price is, probably $50 for the pay-per-view, in addition to Triller, YouTube TV, and PPV.com. But I've been told that this is going to be available. This is going to be available probably sometime in 2025. I don't know that it's going to be available in time for Revolution on March 9th. Right now, AEW is advertising Triller, YouTube TV, or not YouTube TV, but just YouTube, and PPV.com for Revolution. I do expect that it's going to be available on Prime Video sometime this year as an additional place to spend $50 probably for the pay-per-view. And we're still waiting for them to make their announcement about when pay-per-view is going to be available on Max, which you have to be a subscriber for. You will not have to be a subscriber for this on Amazon, just like you don't have to be a subscriber on Amazon Prime Video to, you know, buy or rent a movie, something like that. But they did announce back in October that Max will eventually offer the pay-per-views for subscribers at a discounted rate. But there's no new news on that since then.
I think AEW should be trying to get into as many different distribution channels as possible for its pay-per-views. I think this makes a lot of sense for them to be able to make these available. And I think that's, you know, I feel like that's something to look at over these past number of months where they have expanded. And in light of BR Live being that exclusive US provider, that they have been able to make them available across so many different areas as such. But yes, available to purchase on Amazon Prime.
Yes.
The mysterious show that is AEW Grand Slam Australia. We have a slight update on that courtesy of TNT's schedule. They are trying to keep the show as secret as possible, but man, someone slipped. They put out a start time on the TNT schedule on February the 15th at 10:30 p.m. Eastern time, which would be following the NBA All-Star Weekend coverage on the network. So this would be, airing slightly past the Collision usual start time of 10 Eastern. And that's kind of where we're left to assume that this will end up, assuming it's in a 2-hour format and would be simulcast on Max.
And this is not the game itself.
No.
This is what, the 3-point competition, slam dunk competition or something like that. The game itself is on Sunday night.
Yeah. The game is Sunday.
So it would still be a pretty strong lead in, I would think, but maybe it'll air at 10:30, maybe a little later, or I suppose perhaps even earlier. It's probably just going to depend on when the NBA festivities end.
Yeah, we have not gotten any kind of information on like the tickets out at the new arena that they have moved the show to in Brisbane. So we'll see how overall this shakes out for AEW, this first event in Australia, and if they will be returning anytime soon. It seems like this has been a bit of a confusion in terms of the promotion of this show, which is coming up pretty soon, but we will see what is the end result here and ultimately what they do there. Like, it would seem if you're going all the way there and taking a sizable portion of the roster, that just to do a 2-hour special, that you would maybe do the next week's show as well, or at least get something more out of just the 2-hour commitment that you have for that show.
And it's just a one day event. It's not like they're doing another taping date. There's no plans for that.
Yeah. It's just this one-off show that they have, but they have announced some matches for it. And we'll also see what the Max distribution is as well. Like, if it's just going to air simulcast on Max, if there's any hook to allow it to be live on Max and then you air it on television on tape delay. I don't think that would be what they would opt to go with. I'm imagining they'll just air both at the same time, whether you're watching on Max or
TNT. Right, this is certainly not happening at 10:30. Is it 10:30 or 10? 10:30 on a Saturday night, Australia time to us.
All right. NXT, we have gotten, WWE has launched a new YouTube channel dedicated solely to NXT, which is not anything like earth-shattering, but it would appear like this is going to be its home for its NXT library. That was, since the move to CW, it was a question of where the NXT library was going to end up, and they have just rolled this out. It's a pretty new channel at this point. It's only got like 20,000 subscribers, but they have started populating it with episodes starting in 2012, along with select takeover events. And it seems like they're just going to follow. This will be where they're going to house all of their NXT library that CW is not going to be utilizing. So they're just going to put it on YouTube.
And the SmackDown episodes, as well as the Raw episodes, those are on Netflix internationally?
Yes. Yes.
What this tells me is that if they were not, if they're not licensing the NXT library, you know what they're definitely not licensing?
What's that?
Smoky Mountain, World Class, Mid-South.
I don't know. I think Netflix is way, like, they just, Netflix just had this big quarter, and you, how are you going to follow Q4? I think right. that that's the true. Smoky Mountain release is going to probably carry Q2. That would be my thought.
That's true. If you're going to sustain growth, you probably need to get into the territorial archives of the 1980s.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe there's a whole segment of entertainment reporters that have not learned about Bill Watts that are going to be
there's a lot of lessons there to learn.
There are positive and negative, I guess. I think we have seen the last of Smoky Mountain, Mid-South,
but maybe global. That'll be part of the WWE Vault channel.
I think that that's a place to put it. YouTube is making a lot of sense for them, and I think that that's kind of your,
but all that stuff is in the US on Peacock. I'll be very curious to see what happens in the next term. Presumably they have the rights to, Peacock has the rights to that content. When that deal expires, I would be surprised if that ends up being a part of any sort of new deal in the United States, and they may be just waiting for the domestic deal to get settled before they put that stuff on someplace like WWE Vault.
Yeah, I think that this is the perfect amount of time in terms of, we launched the network. All of these hardcore fans probably got rid of their physical media. And now, over a decade later, it's all going to be gone again. And then that's the time for WWE to get behind this return of physical media, to buy all the stuff that you got rid of.
It's interesting to think about, like, the media sales that they put this through. You know, it's physical media in terms of DVDs, especially when you could have something that was small and not taking up the space of a tape and taking the time to fast forward and rewind and all that. And then it went to subscription video. And I think the next step on some of these deep archive stuff is going to be ad supported video in terms of YouTube.
I wanted to ask you a bit of a question, leaning on some of your past life as a wrestler / trainer. And if you have any thought on one of the big topics coming out of Raw was the injury to JD McDonagh. Are you up to speed on this?
I'm aware that he got hurt. I'm aware he did it on a moonsault. I've not seen it for myself, though.
So he did an Asai moonsault on the side of the ring where the broadcasters are stationed. So after, got an incredible amount of height on this Asai moonsault, and as he lands, the momentum from landing, he smashes his head at a pretty incredible speed into the side of the desk, and he just looked rocked. And Michael Cole is basically freaking out on commentary for somebody to come out and check on him. And there was a doctor that was sent out. He was waved off, and JD McDonagh continued the match. And it's sort of one of those situations, like, how much is he selling versus how much is he affected? Some high flying stuff in this match. Like, he did this big moonsault after the fact. You know, it turns out he broke several ribs and he punctured a lung, which is not fun. And the end result is,
I'm not watching it on loop, so I'm up to speed.
So the end result is sort of this discussion about, you know, who is educated enough to be able to make these determining factors in the moment? When are you making the call to just end a match? Like, here we are, this guy that's wrestling like 12 minutes after this injury with a punctured lung. That can be very, very concerning. And I mean, is it something that, I don't think it's an easy answer either, but relying on the performer to make that judgment call in the middle of a match, to me, would not be enough. That, like, no performer is going to have, I think, that kind of, because it's always going to be ingrained. You finish the match. Yeah. And I think you have to have
it. Would definitely be my inclination. I would never want to stop. I mean, unless, I don't know, unless I was, like, knocked out or something like that. But at that point, what am I deciding if I'm knocked out? I totally feel the instinct to like at least finish the match or go to a finish.
Like among, you know, when you're watching a match, do you feel that you have a special insight to be able to detect when there's a real injury here versus like, is it that like obvious that you can have somebody?
This clip that I'm watching now, it's not obvious to me that he, just from this 5 second clip, I don't know how he was the rest of the match, yeah. But it's not obvious to me that he was definitely injured. I've seen some really terrible looking things that like, oh yeah, he was fine. You know, I've seen plenty of things like including, you know, one thing that comes to mind for me is I remember, you know, one of the wrestlers who we trained took like a disgusting looking German suplex. It was like Vader Inoki 96 and oh my God. And, but he was fine afterwards. So you never know necessarily, I think, you know, at least in the instant that the move happens, whether or not somebody's really in need of medical attention, we need to get out of this match or yeah, he might just be fine.
Yeah, and I mean, this follows last week where Dakota Kai took this missile dropkick, and it was a nasty-looking missile dropkick from Zoe Stark. And again, she finished the match, but after the fact, she's now reportedly in concussion protocol. I think it's very difficult. I think that there is always going to be the default is going to be get through the match, finish the match. The same time, the idea of somebody continuing while it's the head and neck that I think mm-hmm. is going to freak people out. Like there are going to be injuries that you can't gut your way through to the end of the match. I just don't know what the simple solution is here. I mean, to have a doctor at ringside, doctor might not be able to make that determination either on the fly. Like we're not talking about traditional sports where an injury is so detectable. Like this is conveying the idea that you are in pain. That is part of the presentation, and you have to be able to decipher that on the spot on live television and make that judgment call. And you're probably going against the central performer that's going to be arguing their case that they can continue.
Yeah, I guess my assumption when I was a wrestler is that that's what we signed up for. We've sort of taken that into account, and that is part of the risk that we're accepting in participating in this, which is not to say that we shouldn't be more, you know, protect people when we can protect them. But I as a wrestler just sort of took it for granted that, yeah, really serious injuries could happen to me.
Yes. I guess it's, determining as well, if you are the executive level and you're viewing, these are my assets on television as well.
That's right.
Maybe it needs to be a more cold blooded approach to this, that, you being concussed is not good for my business.
Yeah, it's not for sure.
It's not at all. But it's an interesting discussion, and Brandon is able to, I think, give further insight given his background. But I don't know if that acai moonsault would be inspiring you to make a comeback if you were watching that.
No. I guess, like, you know, my thought, too, when we talk about when is it the right time to stop a match is, like, what if it's the main event of WrestleMania? Do you stop it in that situation just as well? A cold, indifferent, you know, advisor who's just concerned with the medical interest of your talent should say yes, you stop it then too. But like the performer in me, you know, wants to say let's figure out some compromise and get to a finish in when the stakes are for the sake of entertainment, you know, quite high.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so many examples that go to that from, you know, famously CM Punk in that Royal Rumble right before he left the company was, you know, basically telling the doctor, like, I'm not getting eliminated. And here was a guy that was like, nah, had a head injury that continued forward. And I mean, we look to, yeah, it was several
famous argument with what Brian Danielson and Paul Levesque were, because was like with the 2013 match with Randy Orton, he was ordered to go to a finish and Brian was furious afterwards.
And that one was extremely visible that the guy had a stinger in the ring, and, you know, and Brian's argument, and this is coming from the performer side of things, is that this is Paul Levesque telling me this, and here is Paul Levesque that one of his most celebrated moments was fighting through a torn quad and getting to the finish, and he was immortalized for that. Now a quad injury...
That wasn't head and neck, yeah.
Exactly. There's a big difference there that I would decipher, but listen, I don't fault a Brian for having that mentality. There is someone that does need to be the bad cop in that situation. And in that moment, it was Paul Levesque who had to be the bad cop, that I completely agreed with Levesque's assessment that, you know, finishing the match, I understand that is your chief objective. But for us, it's making sure we don't have a potential paralysis in the ring, and that you are, you know, permanently. And this is Daniel Bryan as well, someone that has had quite a history of concussion issues and would have further neck issues as well. It's a very difficult line to balance, and I do kind of understand both sides of things. And to your point, that there is always going to be a certain risk taken in these matches, and when you're on live television, that's a big pressure cooker, and it's almost deemed as, if I don't make it to the end of the match, how is this going to impact me, or is there going to be faith lost in me? Am I going to be labeled injury prone? It's all these things in an industry that there is a degree of paranoia attached to it as well.
Yeah, and I was fortunate to never have really any serious injury, certainly not in the midst of a match. On the other side of an injury, though, like I've been in the ring with where like somebody said they're hurt, and I was like, okay, well then I think it's incumbent on the other person who's not injured to do whatever that person wants. You want to go home right away, or whatever they want to do. Yeah, let's go. But I, again, my instinct is that whatever horrible things could happen to us in the ring, we've sort of assumed that risk by stepping in there, which is not everybody's view, by the way. Yeah.
Most of these performers are probably already envisioning their own beautiful day video as well. They're like,
that's right. Especially really at this level. Yeah.
Think about this comeback. Last topic I want to talk about is a pretty incredible month that WWE has had, which is not breaking news to anyone based off of vibes, but we don't operate on vibes. We operate on hard data. And this month was an incredible one for WWE. So if we include Saturday night's main event along with Raw and SmackDown, I did not include NXT in these averages, but Brandon has put all of this together. So we had four Raws, four SmackDowns, a Saturday night's main event, and two NXT shows. And you look here, Raw averaged 14,200 fans per show, SmackDown 10,200, and plus we had a 15,000 plus show for Saturday night's main event this past weekend in San Antonio. NXT, I mean, they are... It's interesting with NXT that they went on the road twice this month, and they operated in very like small venues. And if you were to tell me like The Rock is going to perform in front of 1,100 people at the Shrine Auditorium, and this past Tuesday, they had like, what, 770 people at Center Stage in Atlanta. But that is sort of like NXT knows kind of like going on the road. Like that's, I guess, kind of like their ceiling of what.
And they just announced another date for Cincinnati for another TV taping. It tells you there's some sort of decision there about either they're making enough. This is one I'm less skeptical of. They're making enough money there in terms of ticket sales and maybe merchandise that it's worth their while, or it really pleases their TV partner. You could certainly imagine that CW might be happy to have a larger audience on the TV show that they're broadcasting versus the whatever it is, 200-300 people in the PC. So it may be, even if they're losing a little bit of money, maybe by even operating these events, it might be worth it, or, you know, a small enough loss to, you know, to do something that makes your TV partner really happy.
Yeah, and the venue they have booked in Cincinnati is the Brady Music Center that AEW just did back-to-back nights in Cincinnati as well. So that's where they're going to be going in February. But, yeah, we look at this. 116,000 tickets distributed over the month of January. And just the idea of, you know, the average topping 10,000 for the month. Like these are just incredible numbers to be drawing upon. And I think for Raw, you certainly have to look at just this is bearing fruit, the promotion that the lead up to Netflix received, how important it felt, that kickoff show at the Intuit Dome. That I think just the idea of Raw on Netflix is in and of itself, it feels like a very important show. And like it's not like they've been flooding the shows with Cena or, you know, big names from the past. Like we didn't have Roman Reigns on this past week. It's like I think at this point, like Raw and SmackDown are just this is the brand that is drawing, and the brand is exceptionally hot right now with stars on the shows too.
Yeah, I always think the most meaningful comparisons are, let's look at this Raw or the SmackDown compared to the last time Raw or SmackDown were in this town. And the market comparisons on average in January were up 10% for Raw, 29% for SmackDown. And that tells you they are decreasing their volume, right? I think it's quite notable. There's no house shows in this month of January versus six last year, January. That's not surprising. It's consistent with what our friend Mark Shapiro has been saying about not running as many house shows in smaller markets. So maybe they're creating some scarcity there, but these continue to be higher measurements by WrestleTix anyway, when they go back to these markets, despite what we see in terms of their ticket prices being so high. And maybe there's some inherent risk there. If WWE cools off, maybe they're upsetting fans who won't buy tickets when they have to lower the prices back down someday. I'm less convinced by that notion, but their live event business continues to do really well. And WPR didn't even tell us to say that. It's just the data.
This is the hard facts. Do you feel that there is a notion to that? For here in Toronto, usually every December they would run a house show here post Christmas. Mm. They skipped Toronto this year, but they are coming for Elimination Chamber in March, and they're over 26,000 tickets. Do you think there is an argument there that instead of a Toronto or Buffalo getting maybe one or two TVs and one to two house shows per year, instead it's maybe twice a year, once a year, they're going to be coming to your city, that is going to be a difference maker?
It depends on, I would have to know what the expense, the details about the expenses are that are involved. And I think it can be, it's so hard to estimate that. Mm-hmm. I assume that whatever they're doing is leading to more profitability. Otherwise they would be doing something else. So I would think the answer is yes, considering the highest priority in all of life these days is shareholder interest.
Would you think that this trend continues, that we are going to see virtually zero domestic house shows beyond maybe your Christmas tour, the odd MSG show that they do? And it's international live events. That's where they're going to put their resources if it's not going to be televised.
Right. And do we have any, I'm looking at a WrestleTix spreadsheet of future events, and I don't see any house shows currently
there's
announced.
Nothing on the calendar for the U.S. so far this year.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess so. And this is something that I feel like I've been talking about for, maybe pre-pandemic. Why are we still doing house shows in a business that's so driven by media revenue? And now ticket revenue is just sort of this, side piece that, that's great to have ticket revenue and that increases our margins. But what we're really here to do is to create live programming that broadcasters pay a lot of money for. So does it really make sense to do all these untelevised shows that we're not making any media from hardly?
There's also the thought of, where the argument would be of live events, even if they are a loss leader, it's more so at the NXT level. And it would seem, based on the partnerships that they are creating, their idea is not so much that they're going to just give, they do sporadic live events in the Florida area for NXT, but it's going to be these partnerships with Noah, with TNA. It seems that's going to be their thought, is not so much that you're going to get all these number of matches, but we're going to loan you out. You're going to get experience on other people's TV. You're going to get to work in front of different crowds if you're going over to Japan for a tour. That seems to be the thought. Omos, for instance, we'll send him over to Noah for a month, and now he's coming back. It seems that's more so the idea of partnering with other companies to get talent, more reps at the NXT developmental level. And once you're up to the main roster, you're probably looking at a very low number of matches per month. You're going to be wrestling 1 to 3 times per month, and that's going to be your usual average if you're a rank and file performer.
Yeah. And just to clarify, we do have house shows on WWE's tour schedule here with tickets on sale in Europe as part of their European tour, where they're going to do TV in Italy and Scotland and in London and Spain and all of that. That was all announced a while ago.
Okay. But there's no U.S. house shows.
Right? No domestic house shows.
Gotcha.
No U.S. Canada. Yeah.
So there you have it. That is the WWE front. And skimming through some questions here. Thoughts on how NXT ratings are trending on CW? Has it been an upgrade from the USA Network? And while Brandon takes a look at any data here, we have a decent amount of time now to look since the move to CW, which occurred back in October that they launched on CW. So we do have a 4 months worth of the move. Has this been a game changer?
If it has, it's slight, and I think their demo has been fairly stable, except for maybe in recent weeks. But I'm gonna pull up the latest week. We'll get another rating probably this afternoon for NXT, but for the most recent episode that we do have, which was 14th, is that right? That can't be right.
No, we had
14th. No, I need the 21st. All right, we'll stand by. It's gonna take another minute to find this then.
For last week's show, they did 812,000 viewers, 0.22 in the demo. So that was last week. That was actually, that was their third highest that they have done outside of those first two shows in October that they did. So last week was actually a sizable increase, and not with anything that big on the show either. There was no Rock on that show. There was Bailey appeared, but it was kind of just a regular show out of the Performance Center last week.
Yeah. So what I would want to look at is the year-over-year same week difference. And we do see in terms of total viewership, it's been up in these first 3 weeks of the year, 9, 12, and 25% in total viewership. What we're seeing less of a positive difference, though, is in the demo where it was essentially flat and it was down 9%. It was up 13%. So it's more of a mixed bag. And for people watching in video, the change in network from USA to CW is this dashed blue line, and then going forward, where last year they were under their own performance against USA Network in the same time last year in the demo, and more mixed in terms of total viewership. I think somebody in the comments said, "Well, maybe it's Netflix. You know, the hype around Netflix, Raw being on Netflix, is maybe helping out downstream for NXT." I don't think we're seeing that in the case of SmackDown, though. Maybe that's part of it. Again, this is a show that's grown in viewership year over year for a couple of years now. It's surprising and impressive that they're still gaining viewership. I would think that broadcast does help your older viewers, which is what we saw, when SmackDown was on Fox, is that you had a larger outside the demo audience just because of access, probably.
And Jumanji Hunter asks, what would you consider a good number on Max? I wouldn't pin it down to just like some number that you're just pulling out of the sky. I would look at it this way, that now that we're about a month in since the simulcasting began, especially Dynamite, we have not seen some dramatic decrease in Dynamite's viewership. And I would say if you're pulling an additional like 15 to 20% on Max, and again, we probably are not going to get any kind of data like that, I would be very happy with that amount. But more so, I'd also be happy at the fact that, well, you could look at it both ways, is that the number has stayed relatively stable on TBS Wednesday nights. Does that mean that very, very few are watching it on Max, or that they are doing well on, like, at least by their standards, well on Max, and we're maintaining the television audience, and it's a net positive as well. Without any kind of data to glean from, we are kind of just speculating on this. But
I would say any number of viewers, based on, they seem to have just maintained the viewership that they had on traditional TV. It's down year over year strongly, and that's not good. But in terms of sequential growth or loss, it's been pretty stable. So I would say if you got one extra viewer on Max, well, that's kind of good, right? If you've got 10,000 extra viewers, 100,000 extra viewers, that's even better. Just the fact that it's not hurting the traditional viewership, it seems, makes me say that, well, whatever they're getting is incremental. So yeah, that's great.
It's like your Amazon Prime story. It's like if you're doing 1,000 extra buys on one of these new pay-per-view outlets, well, that's 1,000 buys that you're not getting elsewhere, or it's like that is sort of what you're gauging here. It's just you're available, hopefully, to more people. And in the case of Max, people that are not going to be linear television viewers.
I'm doubtful that it's that many, that it's a large, I'm doubtful that it's like a double digits of percent of the total audience. I would think it's under 10% of the audience combined. But it's important for the future, and in a future where fewer and fewer people are going to have, it's only in about half the US homes. And as time goes on, it's going to get under half, and it's important to be on streaming. And I think that was, that was a good strategy to apply and to get WBD to agree to.
All right. We are going to bring this show to a close, but let's talk a bit about the WrestleNomics report that you can check out over on patreon.com/WrestleNomics, as well as Substack. And Brandon puts this out each and every week, going through many of the big stories. If you are a subscriber, then you would have had that Amazon tidbit in your mailbox long before we discussed it as well. So I'm sure this week, Brandon, what are we going to be doing? A whole fantasy pool for the Royal Rumble? What are we looking ahead to this weekend?
Maybe I've done the pre-work here today for this podcast, so it might be expanding on some of what we went through today and putting it into writing.
All right. And over at postwrestlingcafe.com today, I put up both an audio version and written version on the history of the Royal Rumble. So if you liked our discussion and some of the stats attached to it, that is up for all members at postwrestlingcafe.com. Tonight, I am back with Wei Ting right after Dynamite, whether you're watching on TBS, Max, or TSN2, or wherever you are watching Dynamite. That is where you can catch our review, catching you up on all things AEW related. And that's going to wrap things up for us. A final note is that this Friday, we might be getting the amended complaint from Janelle Grant and her legal team. So
yes,
that's something to watch out for on Friday. And if that is the case, we will see if there are many somewhat or little changes to the original complaint.
What we're going to get on Friday is the argument about why she should be able to amend her complaint, which may amount to revealing what she's going to change about the complaint. But it will not be an amended complaint itself. The judge has to decide whether she's allowed to amend the complaint subsequent to that. And I think we might hear from the defendants an argument against as well.
Okay, so that is the deadline coming up this Friday. So watch out for that. And that is it for us. So thanks, everyone, for joining us. And for Brandon Thurston, I am John Pollock. Thank you for watching and listening. This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, it's your home for XL editions of Rewind to Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown as we go live for our patrons on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with XL editions containing the news of the day, questions, and feedback. And throughout the month of January, you get a free month when you sign up for a full year. postwrestlingcafe.com.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.